question to it.
These are the 15 first pages of the...
That's contents, and then something I handed out.
Okay.
And then what we did with the five books that were questioned, what were the questions, why were they doubted that they should belong to Tanakh, it creates criteria for what we expect of a book to be in Tanakh. So if a book doesn't have those, of course, if a book does not have those expectations, it will be denied entry into the Tanakh. This was considered, of course, a major issue regarding the New Testament, right? Where there were some people who professed Jewish affiliation, who wanted to put other books into the canon of Tanakh. Right? But it's that's an egregious turn from the Tanakh. But in addition, there were books of the Apocrypha, right? Books of the Apocrypha, the Kisvei Achronim, they're called, or Sforim Chatzoniyim, that were also many Jews with more benign intent. The books of the Apocrypha are all, they're not turning anyone away from Torah or a new system. Okay? The major reason why these books are not invited in is because they're beyond the time frame. They are not prophetic, right? Okay. And they are they're often contradictory, right? In fact, that's one of the excuses the Gemara gives for disinviting Mishlei ben Sira. There's contradictions. Well, good Shabbos. Mishlei ben David is also filled with contradictions. What's the difference? What's the difference between the way Chazal treat the two of them? There are contradictions in Mishlei ben David, that's in Tanakh. There are contradictions in Mishlei ben Sira, that's kicked out. So why wasn't Mishlei conclusively kicked out? What did they do to those with those contradictions?
They decided that those were like meant to be kept.
They resolved them. Right? Life is filled with contradictions. They resolve them. Right? One pasuk in Mishlei says, if you see a fool espousing a foolish philosophy, leave him alone. Do not engage him. He's probably good at his sophistry and he might beat you in a debate. Another pasuk in Mishlei says, you better respond to fools, because if you leave him with his foolishness and his philosophies, he's going to take a lot of different people with him, and don't let that happen. Right? Now, if those two verses like that were in the same book, right, you'd either say this book is contradictory, I don't want it in the Bible, right? Human beings contradict themselves all the time, but a book that gets into the Bible should have some resolution, no? Right? So how would you resolve this? By the way, those two psukim are one after the other in Sefer Mishlei. Right? No? Go ahead, try to think of something.
You say that again? How do you resolve the contradictions?
Between one pasuk in Mishnah that says, a fool who espouses foolish philosophies, leave him to his own foolishness. Okay? Starkalo, can you tell me what the contradiction is? Okay. Get off whatever you're looking at and tune in. Okay?
Will you say that the first one is probably wrong, but when you tell the person, if you're just one-on-one with the person, just leave them alone.
Okay,
people,
so what do you do?
Around a group of people, don't let them, like, debate it.
Okay, just think of something. You can't be wrong. Just think of something. It depends on what's the nature of the foolishness. It depends on the person who is responding. Don't respond if he's clearly an expert in rhetoric, he'll wipe the floor with you. But if you feel you're on his level and you can respond to him, maybe it's a difference whether it's public or whether you have him in private. But the two psukim can be explained. All right? They chose not to explain the contradictions in Sefer Mishlei ben Sira. Okay? Incidentally, if you looked at the Gemara that was assigned on Sanhedrin Daf Tzadik Tes, Abaye, you've all heard of him, right? Rabban Abaye. Abaye says, my mother taught me Sefer Mishlei Ben Sira, and she taught me the answers to all of his contradictions. Right? And the Gemara actually includes some of them. Right? Now, Abaye was not necessarily arguing that Mishlei Ben Sira does belong in Tanakh. He would agree that it loses on some other criteria. Any one problem with the five or six that we discussed gets you out of Tanakh. You don't need all the problems. Right? He responded to them. If you find contradictions in Shakespeare, not between one play and another, that's fine. You can contradict Mishlei and Tehillim and also try to give an answer. You know, you held this way because of a certain background, and you held that way because of a different background. But in the same play, there shouldn't be something outright contradictory. All right? A man should not be, let's say, the son of two different people. Okay? So if such a thing appears in a text, we either say, okay, you're out because you're contradictory, or we try to resolve it. Listen, the Torah is filled with hundreds of apparent contradictions. One pasuk says, if you have a worker, pay him before the nightfall. Another pasuk in Devarim says you have to pay him before daybreak. Right? So the Talmud points out this apparent contradiction. He says it depends on what type of worker. A day worker, you have till the next morning to pay him. A night worker, you have till the next evening to pay him. The Torah gives the boss a certain period to pay, unless they have a separate agreement about how they're going to be paid. You pay it every 2 weeks or once a month if that's the agreement. But short of an agreement, so you, if these two psukim, that's what we do. That's what the Talmud does. It's all about conflicting issues. Well, this Mishnah conflicts with that Mishnah, and the Gemara resolves it. Okay, you clear? All right. So I'll give one of the other objections to Mishlei Ben Sira was that it doesn't fit our Weltschauung, doesn't fit our philosophical notion of how we run things. There are things in the book that are just contrary to our notions. And the Gemara gives examples of parental relationships, human sexuality, things like that. The Gemara says, it's not proper. So now I will give you an example from Mishlei Ben David. This pasuk in Mishlei, and there are scores of such psukim, where you have a famous English aphorism, right? And it's just it's twisted a little bit from its original Mishlei, right? A lot of things. Maybe just say some famous phrase, maybe that you remember from Ben Franklin or something, right? Forbidden fruit is sweeter. You ever hear of that? Forbidden fruit is sweeter. And there's some kind of this fruit in Eitz HaDaas was much sweeter than all the other ones. Right? It's more appealing. Yeah? So that's pasuk in Mishlei. Only in Mishlei, because of, it doesn't say it that way. It says, stolen waters are sweeter. Mayim genuvim yimtaku. Right? So there's another saying, spare the rod and spoil the child. You ever heard of that? Spare the rod and spoil the child. It's a little different than Mishlei. It's chosech shivto sonei beno. If you hold back your rod, you hate your child. Now, that was a fair philosophy for about 3,000 years after that pasuk was originally written. But I'll tell you that in the last 50 years, right, probably in the 60s or so, it was determined by a new approach that hitting a child is not to be done. Disciplining is one thing, but to hit a child with a rod, right? So you probably grew up at a time where it would be unheard of for a teacher to actually raise a hand to you, right? Even grab a student by the arm, and that parent, teacher is fired, and maybe even there's a police officer waiting to arrest the teacher at the end of the day, right? But I'm not much older than you. Maybe I have 30 years on you guys. I went to a school right up this block, and every teacher hit us, right? Not just a smack or through chalk at us. I have vision. This particular type of it. I have vision. Teachers punching kids. It's crazy. And I knew the parents were saying, "Good, punch him more. kid needs a little sense knocked in him. Parents were actually okay with that. One particular one was a friend of mine, a couple of years older, and I saw that the teacher was like over him and punching him on the floor. And I remember going over and kicked the teacher. Right? But and then when it got it blew up, and the parents said, "No, I'm okay with it." Crazy, right? So. But today, I must tell you, I raised a bunch of kids, and I never touched them. Never they hit them. Discipline them. Discipline, no doubt. So what do we do with a pasuk like this? Should we throw out Mishle ben David because we have a new philosophy now? Or am I allowed to have a philosophy that contradicts a pasuk in Tanakh? What does the modern Jew do with such pasukim? And there are many like it in Tanakh. So what do you do? Choseich shivto sonei beno. Sorry, Tanakh, you're wrong. And you're going to cut, in your lives, you're going to approach 500 other pasukim like this. Yeah? Of course. You will reinterpret. Now, you see, if you say that shellfish was forbidden by the Torah because they're dirty and they're scavengers, and so when we go out deep into the ocean to get shellfish, now they're clean, so it's now kosher. That's absurd. You're making up the reason why shellfish is forbidden, right? Right? So when we start to see that wool and linen was forbidden because of such and such a practice from the priests of the pagan priests, but now pagan priests aren't doing this anymore, so what do I have to check for Shabbos? You can say this about milk and meat, you can say this about 100 chukim in the Torah. But what gives us the hubris to make something up that moves us away from observance? But this pasuk is not in that realm. I want to know, does the Bible tell me I hate my children because I never hit them with a stick? So the answer is obvious. Rabbi is saying that,
take a metaphor,
the rod is not a yardstick. I remember teachers with a yardstick. It was a yardstick because it was a yard long. And they hit us. I'm not you know, on the hands. I was like, you had to put your hand out and you get a couple of hits. Right? It's wacky. Probably have more pictures of like Mother Superior doing that in the Catholic schools. It did in the yeshivas too. Alright? Lamaisa, yes, that's how we do it. The rod, actually, shevet is the word that's used in the pasuk, and I think on purpose, because in Tanakh, the word shevet is used to describe a whole series of things. In fact, the tongue is called a shevet. It's like a rod, right? Choseich shivto, in other words, discipline your children with your tongue, meaning, you know, tell them the right way. Don't just, you know, Leave him be with bad behavior. Children will, from Adam and Chava acting like children and defying God, taking from a tree that weren't supposed to. We're always testing the limits of what's acceptable. And if those limits keep on getting further and further, forget it. There's no end. All right. Okay, that's canonization. All right. I'd like to discuss a machlokas, the Radak and the Meiri, over a particular issue in canonization that I'm sure you're all aware of, but is instructive of why there should be a what we call a tripartite canon. In other words, why is there Torah, and why should everything else be divided into two things? I understand why Torah should be treated differently. Meaning, why are there three parts to Tanakh? Another way of saying that is, what's the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim? Torah, I understand, has to be treated differently. This Torah is just Torah. It's a guide for everyday life. All right, the Talmud very generously quotes from Nevi'im and Ksuvim, all right, to learn halacha. There's a phenomenally complicated halacha in Tuma and Tahara that's derived from the fact that when Rochav hid the two spies who came to Yericho, you all know what story I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Right? That when Rochav hid those two spies, It said that she hid them under the Pishtei Ha'etz. And the Gemara, there's two pages of Masechet Shabbos that learns all kinds of halachas from this, these two words, Pishtei Ha'etz. Right? Tuma and Tara. Even Hilchos Kilayim gets in on the act from these two words. So that's the nature of canonization. Once it's canonized in the Tanakh, we're going to learn halacha from these things. Got it? When the Gemara in Pesachim says we prefer red wine over white wine for the four cups of Pesach and for Kiddush and for any use of wine, right? It's because of a pasuk in Mishlei that says don't be seduced by the redness of wine. Al tira yayin ki yit adom. Right, at the very end of Mishlei. Right? In other words, that, for instance, if Shakespeare was canonized, so in a play, any statement he makes, to some extent, Shakespeare is canonized in the canon of plays that you can put on in a park or in a theater, right? But this is different. We're determining our behavior and our actions on these out of the way references. So there's a lot at stake here. All right. So what's interesting in the Via Miksuvim? So the Radak and the Meiri. Radak lived first, right? Radak is in the 13th century, contemporary of the Ramban. Radak cites. I'm going to tell you the Gemara, and it's amazing how the Radak and the Meiri use the same Gemara to say almost the exact opposite explanation. It's amazing. Listen to the Gemara. Gemara cites a story in Sefer Daniel. This is what appears in the text of Daniel. Daniel is walking with three colleagues. The three colleagues in Daniel are not named. He just says they are three of his colleagues. The four of them begin to sense something trembling and something awesome. Daniel begins to see it, and he asks his three friends if they see it also. They say no, but they feel something in the air that is extremely terrifying, and they run from the place. Daniel holds his ground, perceives this thing, which is some kind of beast with horns and breathing fire and things like that. He perceives the thing, describes it, and then gives a prophecy about it. Right? Referring to certain nations that are going to rise in the coming years and wreak havoc across the world. Okay? You all with me? The Gemara now picks up. Ad Kan is in the Bible. The Gemara picks up and says, those three men were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Right? Is it anachronistic to say that Daniel knew Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi? It would have to be that Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are much younger than he is, and he's got to be 80, 90 years old. Which is fine, okay. An 85-year-old Daniel is met up with these the Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi in their teens or 20s, and this is what I just described happened. Okay, you with me? Because Daniel, it says in Tanakh, left Israel with the galus of Jehoiachin, right? He was a little child, maybe. It'd have to be about 3, 4, 5 years old for him to know Haggai, Zechariah, be with Haggai, Zechariah. But you know what? The Gemara can just say this, who are three men and prophets together? Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. It doesn't matter, really. Here's what matters. Daniel, after they escape, after they flee, and he perceives and describes the prophecy. He says, I am greater than they are, and they are greater than I am. I am greater than they are because I saw the vision and held my ground and described it, and they were unable to. Now, what I just described could be because they're just starting in their prophecy, and I'm a seasoned prophet. Right? I've been through this before. Look at Daniel's first prophecy in the beginning of the book. It says he melted away and fell to the ground and couldn't handle himself. Maybe this is their first prophecy. All right, I'm just saying. Okay, maybe you remember this Gemara. It's the very beginning of Maseches Megillah, Daf Gimel. It's also at the end of Sanhedrin, which is a Daf Yomi in a few weeks. Is going to get up to this story. So he says, I am greater than they are because I saw it. They are greater than I am because they are Nevi'im and I'm not. What do you mean I'm not? I just saw it in prophecy and I just spoke about it. Right? So the Radak says, how can the Gemara say Daniel is not a Navi? So what's the answer?
He's not.
Come on, look at the board and tell
he's
me.
A Kutu.
He's in Ksuvim. Daniel is canonized in Ksuvim. Chagai Schari Malachai at the end of Navi. So the Radak explains the Gemara that what Daniel is saying is, I'm stuck here in Ksuvim. They got to be in Nevi'im. Which according to the Radak, can you give me a phrase of what's your divine inspiration if you're in Ksuvim lower than Nevuah? What would you call that? Some people say that Rashi wrote under this inspiration.
Ruach
HaKodesh, that's what we call it. Others say that Rashi wrote the Nevuah. No one should go that far. But Rashi wrote the Ruach HaKodesh. I think McCartney and Lennon wrote the Ruach HaKodesh. All right? It means that you're inspired to do something that not one in a billion people on earth can do. All right? Certain inventions, it's an inspiration. It proves God. Okay? All right? It came to you from something. Okay? All right, so that's the Radak. If you're in Nevi'im, it's Nevuah. If you're in Ksuvim, it's Ruach HaKodesh. Is this convincing? Anyone want to comment on it? Anyone disagree with this kind of... Anyone have a problem with this interpretation? Because the Meiri says, when I read this, I couldn't believe someone could give this explanation. The Meiri says this in his introduction to Sefer Tehillim. Okay? And the Radak says it also in his introduction to Sefer Tehillim. Tehillim is the first book of Ksuvim, right? In our Tanakhs. In the Gemara, Rus was the first. But anyway, it's in the Gemara Tehillim. Yes?
They were so young, did they already write like
Nevi'im? Okay, I mean, the Radak and the Meiri don't go where I you know. You just say they were Nevi'im at that point. I was just explaining the Gemara in terms of the history of it all. It would be a stretch to say that that's, it could possibly be Chagai Schar Malachi, but it doesn't matter. The Gemara is. When you learn Agadita, we have a whole week on how to read Agadita in the Gemara. This is certainly Agadita. There's no halacha in this, right? But what still stands is that the Gemara does seem to be comparing three Nevi'im and Nevi'im, one Navi in Ksuvim, and the Gemara has the Navi that's in Ksuvim bemoaning the fact that he never got into Ksuvim. I'm sorry, into Nevi'im. So, okay, we have a difference in Nevi'im and Ksuvim. It's in the Gavra. You get it? The ability of the individual. They, although in their youth, right, I'm the seasoned Navi for 60, 70 years, they are going to surpass me. Right? Because they are Nevi'im and I'm just Ruach HaKodesh. And I acknowledge that. So why was I able to see this in them? Not now, I'll kick in this point. I've been doing this for a long time. They're just getting started. Right? Okay. This is the Radak. Right? Here is the Meiri's objection. And he uses the same Gemara. He agrees, he says, okay, I'm going with the Gemara. I'm using the Gemara. He says there's a very different reason why Daniel says, I'm not a Navi. If he agrees, it means I'm not a Nevi'im. But wait a second. Someone who says Daniel is not a Navi hasn't read Sefer Daniel. Now, the Radak certainly read Daniel and commented on Daniel. See, Daniel was studied very much and commented significantly. Sir Sajagon wrote a commentary to Daniel. There wasn't even a commentary to the Torah yet at the time of Sajagon. But he wrote a commentary to Daniel. You have to know the context. The last three chapters of Daniel are significantly used by Christians to predict the date of the arrival of Jesus. Very polemical. Let the end of Sefer Daniel. I will confess now, I know we're on tape, that the reason why I started studying Tanakh is because of a total ignorance of what Daniel was about. The year I spent in Israel, they used to let you, oh goodness, they don't let you do today what we did then, but we had office sukkahs,
And a bunch of us just went camping all over Israel on our own, right? So 1 week we spent in, we had about 2 weeks off. About 3 or 4 days we spent sleeping on the shores of the Kinneret. Right? Imagine doing that now. So every night we'd go into Tveria and we'd find places to eat, right? So and you know the amazing thing, this is 40 some years ago, and I'm still in touch with all the guys we went with. It's amazing. It's a shout out to you guys, all right? Jay Zavaro, happy birthday. I know today's your birthday. All right, so it just so happens. Anyway, so I was in the South Kedushin also. So here it is. When we go into the town one night, we're surrounded by these guys with their backpacks on, you know, these missionaries. And they were so convincing that about looking, showing us these psukim in Daniel about the arrival of Jesus in Jerusalem based on his prophecies. They had everything mapped out. And frankly, we didn't know anything. We didn't even know what Daniel was about. We didn't know one prophecy in Daniel, right? So I remember just going back to Yeshiva and saying, this is not going to happen again. I bought myself this Koran Tanakh, you know, in English. Went through one parak a day. I got this book called HaTalmud al HaTanakh. And I started steigen in Tanakh. I said, that's not going to happen to me again. I used to go, even in Israel, I used to go with someone else in the Yeshiva to debate the missionaries and to go back, you know, to go on the offensive with them, right? These missionary stores of Ben Yehuda, they're still there, actually, selling these, and they have Yiddish, they have in Hebrew, they have Yiddish, they have evangelical stuff in Yiddish, for goodness sakes. Who speaks Yiddish that wants to read that? Anyway, the Meiri says, it's inconceivable for someone to read Sefer Daniel and say this is not a prophet speaking. It's inconceivable. The Meiri says, look on that same page, and Daf Gimel and Meseches Megillah, and this comes up after the recess. You've heard of the Targum to the Torah was written by Onkelos. The Targum to Nevi'im is Yonas and Ben Uziel. And the Gemara says, who wrote the Targum to Ksuvim? He says, there's no Targum to Ksuvim. You don't want a Targum to Ksuvim. Right? Even though, we'll have to talk then, if you open up any Ksuvim, there is a Targum. Who wrote that? All right? As far as the Gemara is concerned, there isn't a Targum to Ksuvim, and there shouldn't be a Targum to Ksuvim. Right?
Doesn't matter how the Niels
so, what's wrong with Ksuvim?
Predictions about when Mashiach will come.
Correct. There are predictions, not only in Daniel, but they're according to the Rosh, there are some others elsewhere in Ksuvim, but Daniel is certainly the place. There are 3 whole chapters telling us how long to wait, what we're waiting for, okay? So Daniel, and there over the years, there's a great book called Messianic Predictions, I think it's called. It gives, there's a book that collects something like 200 dates that were advanced. Of course, you give it to like 100 years after, you're not going to be around, so you don't have to answer in your lifetime for why this date came and went and did, and nothing happened, right? But there are like 200 dates for people who predicted a coming of Mashiach. Ramban even got in on the act. The Vilna Gaon got in on the act. Right? They all predicted 5100, 1840, all kinds of dates. 1666, that led to the Shabtai Tzvi debacle. So all these dates that were predicted, of course, have come and gone. But they all start off with Daniel. Some of them use Yecheskel, some of them use Eov, some of them use... But there is a prediction in Ksuvim, so I don't want a Targum. Ostensibly, if there was a Targum, the Targum would be so explanatory of these very cryptic Psukim that we would be able to mamash figure out when Mashiach is coming if there was a written good Targum. Okay, an authoritative Targum, like Onkelos and Yonas and Menuzio. So you're telling me, says the Meiri, that in light of that Gemara, you're telling me that Daniel's not a Navi? Right? So he says, of course Daniel's a Navi. In fact, he's a better Navi than Chagai Zecharia Malachi. So why is he in Ksuvim? So, Meiri says, the difference between Navi and Ksuvim is not a function of the Gavra, of the ability of the particular Navi. Excuse me, Moshe's the author of a book in Ksuvim. Which book? You're all stumped? Who? What book did Moshe write? Eov. All right? Okay, guys, come on. All right. So, what does that mean? When Moshe wrote the Torah, he was on the highest madrega, but he was on the low madrega when he wrote Eov. parenthetically, in the Gemara's list, these two prophets have books both in Nevi'im and Ksuvim. Right? Shmuel has Shoftim. Shmuel. And anybody want to call it out? Yirmiyahu has Malachim, like Shoftim, but by history. His own book, like Shmuel. And Eicha. Okay? I'll answer that question in a minute. Let's go back to the Meiri's explanation. It's not a function of the Gavra. What level are you on? Ruach HaKodesh, you're stuck in Ksuvim. Nevuah, okay, you get into Nevi'im. No, it's a function of the Cheftza, giving you some lumdish terms. Not a function of what you're up to. It's a function of how does God want you to pass over your Nevuah. Everybody in Tanakh is a Navi. Right? How does God want you to pass over your Nevuah? Now look at the two words and tell me. The word Navi comes from the word Niv. Ore Niv Sfosayim. Navi is a spokesman. Navi speaks. Ko Amar Hashem appears hundreds of times in Nevi'im, but not once in Ksuvim. Because if you're in Nevi'im, you have two missions. To give sermons, stand on a box, and tell people what God's word is, and you have to write it down for the future. So you can read Haftorahs from it, you can teach it, you can say what's relevant of it in the future, even learn halachas from it, about how to, about Tumah and Tahor, right? So put it down, be careful, be specific, be explicit. If you're in Ksuvim, you only have one of those roles. Get it? So I'm not a Navi, which according to the Meiri means God Adaraba. Look throughout the meal. Hashem tells him, don't tell this to anybody. The last two psukim in Daniel, Hashem tells him, write down what I told you. Seal it. Don't let anybody now know what this is about. Put it away and write it up when you know it someday. Right? That's the point of Ksuvim. Right? You know what I'm saying? There may be prophetic things even in Tehillim, but no one got up on a soapbox and said, listen to these words, Chevra, Al Naros Babel Shom Yoshem. No. Ko Amar Hashem, God doesn't like what you're doing. Too many widows and orphans are being mistreated in this place. That's Nevuah. You get it? Ksuvim is also Nevuah, but this is Nevuah to be spoken as well as written. This is only Nevuah to only be written. Okay? Now, I'll take Mr. Stafsky's question, and then we're going to try to apply the Radak and the Meiri to this phenomenon. Why does one Navi have a book in both places? Right, Vaughan? Yes?
So if that's the case, then you would think that in the Nevi'im they would just speak it and not write it. If in the Ketuvim they're writing it but not speaking it. Why are they writing it down in the Nevi'im if
the same reason why any rabbi who gives sermons over a 40-year period often writes a book about his sermons. He wants it to be used later. These are my best sermons. I'm kidding. If Yeshayahu would record everything he spoke, it would be 80 Yeshayahus. It would be 150 Yeshayahus. Right? Okay? Yes?
That's what the Radak says, right? The Vua and the...
Radak says it's in Gavra. If you're in a higher Madrega, who are you? What's your level? That will define your higher Madrega, Nevi'im, lower Madrega, Ksuvim.
And Meiri is the mission of
them? Meiri says it's in a Cheftza. Cheftza means not who you are, but what's the nature of the thing, the Chefetz, that God gave you. If it's something to say over to the public, right? To speak. Remember, the word Navi means Niv.
Yeah.
Niv. Other words for prophet, which doesn't necessarily refer to speech, is a Chose or a Ro'eh. Right? The Navi is that, and it's interesting because in the time of Shmuel, only one prophet is called a Navi, that's Nasan HaNavi. He is so, his speeches and Sefer
Sefer Shmuel are brilliant. All right, he's the one called the Navi, as opposed to Shmuel and God, who are called Shmuel HaRoeh and God HaChozeh. Right? Shmuel's job was not to stand on boxes and spread out. You know, he just did the job. You know. Okay. All right. Enough on that. Let's just. I'm going to finish off with Tikkun Sofrim and Ta'amei HaMikra. I'll start with Ta'amei HaMikra. Okay. Ta'amei HaMikra, you know most of you laying for your bar mitzvah, right? Okay. So the Ta'amei HaMikra is not just a fancy kind of reading of to make it sound good, right? Ta'amei HaMikra is punctuation. Okay? Page 28. I have a page on Ta'amei HaMikra. It's punctuation. All the ta'amim just fall into two categories. They are either a mafsik or a mishorit. And if you're in any way musical, you can hear it. Right? Mapach, pashto. Mapach, mishores. Mapach wants you to, don't stop here. Don't ever stop at a mishores. Right? The most common mishores is, of course, the munach. Don't ever stop at that word. That means munach, go to the next word. Right? And if the next word is also munach, then go to the next word. Right? Always stop at a mafsik. Right? If you're not sure what the translation is, but you at least want to make the person listening to you know that you know what you're saying, okay. If you stop at a mishareis, it means you don't know what you're saying. You don't know what you're learning. Okay. Right? The mafsikim are either comma, colon, semicolon or period. Period is easy. The period is the sof pasuk. Right? Colon is the esnachta. Right? These two, depending on the type of mishores and mafsik is being used, some mafsikim are more valuable and more significant than others. Ger shayim, a pozer, a tlisha, these are longer stops, right? You can hear it in the music. We maybe have different names for these things.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so that's just it. Okay, I just want you to be aware of this, that the Ta'amim, the Gemara says, was instituted by Ezra. It's part of our Masorah. Okay? There may be on occasion a difference, just a small difference. He has a Pazer, he has a Gershayim, but that's very rare. Okay, this number. Now, I just with the purpose of what I gave you on page 28 is just a it's a small just a collection of a few examples where it seems that Rashi used the Ta'amei HaMikra for his pshat, for his peirush, I should say, and not pshat. Okay, see this pasuk here when Yaakov sees his father. And his father says, comes into the room and he says, Avi, my father. Now, Yitzchak knows that there are two people who might call him father. When he says, who are you? He's saying, basically, I'm not sure if you're Esav or Yaakov. No accusation. Right? If it's Esav, then I'm... like when you order out food and you're really hungry and the doorbell rings, you go, right? Pizza came, the Chinese came, whatever it is. You know? So Yitzchak is probably wondering, how did he get here so fast? He just left. Right? Usually takes another 2 hours to bring me the food. It's not the first time Yitzchak asked Esav to get him food. Right? Okay, so when he says, Mi ata bani, it could be, is it Yaakov just coming to ask me a question or something? Or is it Esav with the food so soon? And Yaakov answers, he thinks, a little too many words, but he says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha, Osisi Kasher Dibarte Elayi, Kunoshua, etc., etc. He speaks a lot longer than Esav does. Esav doesn't have to announce himself as your Bechor, right?
But Yaakov, you know, he's trying very hard to be convincing, so he's maybe a little too convincing. But Yitzchak is a little naive, and he's old, and he's not picking up on this. So, Anochi Esav Bechorecha is an outright lie, right? But Rashi says that he's not lying with these three words. Remember what you ever see Rashi on this? What does he mean? What does he say?
Basically, there's a separation when you read it. Like,
yes.
Pashtai.
Yes, it's indeed a Pashtai.
I am who I am, and then Esav Bechorecha.
Okay. If you would translate this into English, it should be Anochi Esav Bechorecha. Right? What made Rashi say this, you know, it's so far from the Pshat, right? So I will tell you that when you look into a Perush, this is what we do later in the semester, you'll see there's a lot that goes into a Perush. Rashi, we lived at a time where Christians made accusations against the Jewish nation of being immoral, and you're learning from your father Yaakov. Right? So Christian commentaries at this time feel that Yaakov mistreats his brother throughout the parsha. Right? So when you're living in such a background, so you try to rear back and say, no, it was Esav who was acting immorally. He sold Yaakov this birthright when they were younger, right? Not for a bowl of porridge. Yaakov gave him something of extreme value. He said, Yaakov nosan le'Esav. He had given him the food to cement a deal. When you made a deal, you ate something. That food was not for you. Esav is going to sell his whole birthright for a bowl of soup? No, the bowl of soup was to cement the deal, right? All right. So Rashi writes that it was Esav acting immorally when his father said, "I want to give you the bracha because I don't know how much longer I'm going to live." Esav should have said, Dad, this is not mine. I sold this when I was younger. I know that's the wrong thing to do. But Yaakov gave me something when you were much younger, and I'd like to demur. I shouldn't be getting this bracha." Okay? Now, you may like or not like that approach to the story, but you have to understand the historical background as to why someone living in France, the Sephardic commentaries were not exposed to these Christian diatribes generally did not go there. Okay, but just get back to this. You're right. It's based, the trop should have been, I am, not I am Esav Yebachor, but I am Esav Yebachor. All right? So I'm just giving you one example. I submit to you here that there are scores and scores of Perushim of Rashi to the Torah, where he says something that does not appear to be pshat in any way. Even English translations don't. Even the art scrolls, the holy art scrolls, where it doesn't read, I am who I am, right? Esav is your bechor, now come and eat then. No lie here, right? Even the art scrolls reads, I am Esav, your bechor. Yes?
That being said, with what was going on at the time of Rashi, possibly just a vindication for Yaakov that he was looking for?
Yes, there's no doubt there is schar amongst the Rishonim to paint the Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov as good a way as possible. But Rashi wasn't shy about explaining Avraham, and you know, Avraham made a mistake here. He does it, you know, pretty often in his time. This is it's not so simple that, you know, each and every Rashi, it's not so simple to predict what was happening in his own time that made him say such a thing like this. But those who, you know, read Rashi very carefully and 100 times, can sometimes sense, like when Moshe hits the Egyptian or when he reacts to the Hebrew who said, "You killed me like you killed the Egyptian," Rashi seems to be saying something about a social commentary in France on that puzzle. Right? How Jews are behaving. So, to prove such a thing, can you prove such a thing? That's worthy of an article or a chapter in a book, right? You know, the scholars are not so quick to accept such a thing, right? But here, the debate between about whether Yaakov is the bad guy here or Esav is the bad guy. No one who reads the rest of Sefer Bereishis can deny that Yaakov did something wrong here. He falls in love with a younger sister, gets an older sister, right? You get it? Lo yaseh kein bimkom meinu. We don't in our place, we don't put younger ones before the older ones. I thought we had a deal. Yeah, what about your brother? And Yaakov says to this is in the Medrash, he says to Leah, how did you do this to your sister? He goes, and you didn't do something like this to your brother? So the rabbis and Rashi, and the, you know, they could find, you know, you can't deny that the text itself, the storyline itself, unfolds to say Yaakov's doing something wrong here. Like us, and I'll close with this, you know, Rosh Hashanah Kippur time, we were always faced with things where, should I listen to my mother? Should I not listen to my mother? My mother convinced me that God told her when she was pregnant that the younger one will be better, will prevail. Why doesn't my father need? Why do I have to trick him? Why couldn't Yaakov say to his mother, Mom, am I either supposed to get the bracha you're trying to get me to do through trickery or not? If I'm supposed to get this bracha, I'll get it some one way or the other. If I'm not supposed to, I certainly don't want to get it through chicanery. Right? So, okay, that's an issue. Okay, so that's what we just want you to be clear that Rashi used the ta'amim significantly in that to affect his parshanut. Right? On Tuesday we're still going to do this thing called Tikkun Sofer. It's very, very, very charged discussion. Just coincidentally, that's what we call the book that you prepare your lady from, right? It's called the Tikkun Sofer. But it's a totally different topic in our discussion. And just by a show of hands, how many of you expect to be here a week from today? So some of you? Okay, I'll be here. Of course, I'll be here. Okay. Mr. Starkle, if you had a question, I saw your hand up before. You had something on this? Okay, if you want to talk to me afterwards, though.
Thank you, Rosh Hashanah.
Okay, guys, be well. See you at Tova. Everybody have a place for Rosh Hashanah? You're all, everyone covered, right?
Well, wait, the seven questions.
Please take one right here.